Police and prisons are violent and racist institutions straight out of a colonial legacy whose sole contribution is to reproduce the inequities of the capitalist system. Every day, even when they uphold a so-called social peace, the cops only assault, harass, and incarcerate the most vulnerable and oppressed among us. And when people rise up against these injustices, once again the state uses the police and prisons to stifle the masses. The problem is not only the violent blunders of the police, but the police institution in itself that is a form of violence, just like the courts, the laws, the jails, and the prisons. Can we really talk about bad apples when the whole institution only exists to repress and oppress? The Whole Orchard is a series of podcasts in the form of interviews that addresses different themes linked to the police, prison, and justice systems that was created by CLAC, the Anti-Capitalist Convergence, a group based in Diodiagé, or so-called Montreal, on unceded indigenous land, inhabited amongst others by the Ganyangahaga Nation. We're proposing a critical analysis to oppose the naive liberal perspective that only targets the bad apples in the basket instead of fighting structures of oppression. We can't leave them such a chance. We refuse to reform a system with rotten foundations. Instead, we abolish it. Let's take on the whole orchard. Prisons and the restriction of spatial mobility as a mode of punishment have only become normalized recently in the West. Before those, we often thought about corporeal punishment devices such as the torture wheel, the guillotine, or the pyre, symbols of the excesses of royalty and feudalism. However, up until recently, many rural communities functioned without any intervention from the state. Economic dynamics imposed a large agricultural production, and as long as the producers stood in line with it, there was no reason to intervene. That's why there is a much larger police presence in the cities than there is in rural regions, even though crime rates are higher outside of metropolitan areas. Therefore, it's not surprising that in so-called Quebec, prisons would only appear in the 19th century and establish themselves through the introduction of police services. However, it's important to remember that other solutions have and will continue to exist to replace the punitive justice system and its rampant sequestration of peoples. With the aim to abolish the carceral system, drawing inspiration from those alternative approaches to justice seems essential. But until then, we also need to change what we believe constitutes, quote-unquote, a crime. In the third episode of our podcast, we present to you this interview with two members of the Termite Collective in order to deepen our understanding of the issues related to prison abolition. The Termite Collective is a group based in so-called Montreal that supports incarcerated individuals and aims to share a critical analysis of the carceral system by spreading information via workshops, theater plays, and other events. Can you tell us a bit about the work you do in the Termite Collective?
So the Termite Collective is a group of people who are very determined to abolish prisons. And we are a group of people, some of whom have a lot of experience in prison and some of whom don't. And we collaborate together on various different kinds of projects. Most publicly, we recorded and performed some plays years ago, and we were very interested in cabaret and playwriting and performance as a way to educate people about what happens in the prison system and to help people understand why abolition is so necessary.
Briefly, could you expand a bit on why we would want a world without prisons?
I think one of the reasons why we would want a world without prisons is because we've realized what a bad experiment that has been, and the links to a system that is actually ultimately very oppressive, and how it's one of the ends of a strategy, one of the last points of a strategy that continuously and systematically targets certain populations and has as its goal to ensure the stability and good working order of a system that actually causes a lot of harm rather than any good. Without going to more detail with that, I think that's one of the goals why we would want a world without prisons. Another goal that I think most people could relate to is the harm that long-term institutionalization does to people. I think most people would agree that being caged for an extended period of time is not a good thing to do to each other. So even at the most basic level of human understanding, I think we could all agree on that.
I would add two things. One is kind of what you're touching on, of like prison abolition is deeply connected to wanting to live in a world where people have what they need and are not harmed by our ways of interacting with each other. And prisons are deeply connected to histories of colonialism in this context, to histories of slavery in the United States. And here, you know, some of the first people to be held in prisons in Canada were Indigenous leaders who were leading uprisings against the expansion of the Canadian state. You know, if you look into the history of a federal prison like Stony Mountain, some of the first people in that prison were people who fought against the Canadian state during the Northwest Rebellion, and some of the first wardens and people working in that prison were soldiers who were shipped out west in order to fight that rebellion. So, you know, there's a really deep history of prisons interacting with colonialism. And so when we're talking about prison abolition, we're thinking about, you know, a world in which colonialism doesn't exist either, and just seeing prisons as one aspect of the oppressive power structures that you mentioned that really stop people from being able to access the things they need and have the kinds of relationships that they want to have, both to the land and to each other. And then another thing I would add is that that kind of gives you a sense of what we mean when we say something like the prison industrial complex, which is a big term that a lot of people, a lot of prison abolitionists use to convey the sense that we're not just talking about the buildings of the prisons themselves. Like, the buildings could close and we would still have an issue with the system. The prison industrial complex is actually deeply connected to capitalism. It's about all of the corporations that are making money off of housing people in prison. It's about, you know, all the social services that make a lot of money off of, you know, supporting, quote-unquote, supporting people on parole or, helping people follow the rules of their ankle bracelet program or things like that. Those things all count as part of the prison industrial complex. So when we talk about prison abolition, we're not just talking about getting rid of the buildings with the walls themselves. We're talking about this much more giant system that makes it much harder to fight in some ways, but also points towards the world that we want to live in and the more positive things that we're fighting for.
I could probably add to that in terms of the way it's thought about. It's not necessarily a prison abolition, even though the term could be, that's enough to start off a conversation about it. The way you've spoken about it obviously makes us think of penal abolition and punishment as a goal of justice or of reducing harm and for reparation.
Yeah. La noche se pone triste. Another night fighting polices. Folks and peoples make pieces. CNN don't retweet this. Brothers and their hermanos share moment of sorrow. Differences put aside. The mission not coincides. Pounds and flicks. Handshakes and raised fists. This ain't happened since Hampton was passing out Panther pamphlets. That's it. Que lo que falta. About to align these chakras. Move the rock at Gibraltar. Shit. Do whatever we got to. Porque no estamos pa' siempre. Don't know how this is ending, but I know who to defend when the going get tough. Fighter we run, if we united I ain't worried about none. What's the size of the gun to an idea thrown to the sun? Come on.
So, if we didn't have prisons, how exactly would we deal with crime?
First of all, let's start this way. We've always been dealing with crime. If we're going to call it crime, or let's call it harm, because that's more reflective of what we would like to see, is like addressing harm done. And we have always been dealing with harm done against us, on us, within our communities. We have many strategies, and even in the most gruesome situations, we are left to grieve and to move on our own regardless. And I'm not just talking about interpersonal harm, I'm talking about the harm from colonialism, work-related issue. In every context, we have been dealing with harm. So we have the means to deal with harm, even though they're not ideal, we have been dealing with them. So we could learn from that, on how we've dealt with the harm that has been done with us, that has never been addressed as a crime, and that has never been addressed as something worth rectifying to any real degree. The other thing is that there are ways, when there is harm being done to each other on that interpersonal level, the way things are done as they stand is that there is one person responsible for the harm, and it's punitive, and one person needs to be put away for that harm to be addressed. And of course, that's, I don't think anybody, even on that level, is satisfied. Again, I'm going to go to the basic level of all of us, that even in the system, those who have gone through the system as victims don't see it satisfying or reparative in any real way either.
I would just say that what counts as crime in our society today is telling in terms of what, you know, people in power think needs to be addressed in terms of harm. So people who run giant factories where people get injured are often not going to face criminal charges for those actions, even if, you know, they knew that the machines that were operating in their factories were unsafe. The corporations that spill oil into the ocean and onto the land, they often don't face any consequences for having done that. Most police officers who are involved in killing people don't face any charges for that. Just to say that a lot of things that we could think of as harm don't count as crimes. And so there's a big disconnect between, you know, the way the legal system defines what counts as a crime versus something that grassroots and people in different communities could define as a harm. And being able to see that difference and see that distinction can kind of lead you into the direction of what we would do if we didn't have prison, which I think has been less of a conversation in the last 6 months than what would we do if we didn't have police. I think George Floyd's murder in the United States really brought to the forefront a conversation about what would we do if we didn't have police. And there are a lot of amazing organizations that have been working on giving people answers to that question. Some of the ones that come to mind for me are groups like Critical Resistance, which have also dealt a lot with penal abolition, and a lot of different groups that have operated in different neighborhoods where people haven't been able to call the cops for whatever reason, or if they did, the cops wouldn't come, or communities where people know that the cops aren't going to solve their problems, and so they have more grassroots ways of dealing with issues that come up in community, whether it's around conflict or whether it's around harm. Yeah, so I think having that distinction is useful. The distinction between crime and harm is really useful. I think there are some pretty inspiring examples around the world of ways that people have dealt with harm without using punitive measures like prisons. The one we were talking about, this mythic example the other day when we were preparing for this interview, gets told to me. It has been told to me as a story about the Zapatistas. I have never been able to find the source of where it actually comes from, so I feel unclear on whether it's actually about the Zapatistas or whether it's about, you know, a community that has achieved a high level of autonomy from state structures and is able to experiment with how they deal with harm in their own way. But the story is that there's a community in which someone murdered someone else, possibly in the context of a conflict that they were having. And the decision that the community made in terms of what should happen for that person in terms of consequences is that that person ended up living with the family of the person he had killed. And part of that is because the way the story goes is that it was like a very rural community where people were very dependent on farming for, you know, getting their food and access to food for the community and things like that. And the family that had lost a family member needed help with the farming and needed help with, you know, getting their food. And so the consequence for that person was to live with the family of the person they had killed for a year. And I think that gets brought up. We were talking about it as this mythic story that gets brought up as like an example of something that could happen that isn't prison, that isn't punitive, that isn't about punishment, but is about reparation and is about trying to directly deal with harm in a way that includes the people who have been harmed in that decision-making process and in that conversation.
The unemployed graduate, the teachers ain't having it. Cameras sending us to prison instead of sending us to college. The janitor's mop can't clean the situation when the dictator of our nation is called a corporation. Swear to God and my mama never supported Obama. I'm a Chicago riot starter like a Haymarket martyr. I'd rather focus on the streets, organizing the tribes. Go against the grain and know that I tried. I'm not into working backwards, I'm talking direct action. I'm talking fighting for freedom for the poor and working classes. I will work for reform, this is for my unborn. I'm putting on a ski mask and this weapon is drawn.
Okay, I'm convinced. So now, how do we get there?
I think one of the things is to use imagination to look at examples of praxis that has worked and has not relied on state structures to both define and address harm.
I think there's a giant spectrum of things that people are trying in order to get to there. And some of them are more collective organizational strategies. There's groups like Critical Resistance, who I mentioned, who have a lot of things that they've written about non-reformist reforms, which is something they talk about, which looks like refusing to lobby for prisons that aren't double bunked, because that often leads to more prisons getting built, and instead being clear that when you are talking to the government about what you want to see happen, you have to make sure that it's the end result is resources being pulled away from the prison system as much as possible. But then there's also things that fall into the category of transformative justice. Sometimes they look like circle processes. Sometimes that looks like conflict mediation. That whole genre of thing that I think of as like communities sitting down and trying to figure out how to deal with conflict and harm themselves, and different facilitation strategies people have come up with around that, and different like structured processes that people have come up with around that. There's a lot of groups that have done that over the years. Some of the ones that I have read the most about that come to mind are groups like Philly Stands Up and Philly's Pissed. I don't think they exist anymore, but there's a lot of writing online from them about both supporting people who have caused harm and what kinds of transformative change you can encourage people to bring about in their own lives when they're willing and they have the right support system, but also about supporting people who've been harmed and what that looks like. There are lots of Black feminist organizations that have done this kind of work in the past. In Montreal, there's the Third Eye Collective that has, in the last like 5 or 10 years, done a lot of work around that in Montreal. And then there's grassroots conflict mediation stuff, which has looked all kinds of ways. There's lots of little groups around the city who try and do that kind of thing. There's lots of like grassroots facilitators who are willing to step in and help with those kinds of things, with the goal in those situations of not involving the police. I will briefly mention a few more strategies that I think are moving us in a direction of abolition. One is things like public shaming, which the Me Too movement has popularized in the last 5 years or so. And another is material reparations, which in the United States usually gets talked about as material reparations for people whose ancestors were enslaved. But in Canada, I think we can also talk about it as land back, which is a slogan that has become very popular on the internet in the last few years, but has always been a slogan of the anti-colonial movements and Indigenous sovereignty movements who are pushing for literally land back, that I would think of as like a material reparation in the context of the harm caused by colonialism. I will briefly mention a few more abolitionist organizations. There's the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement, which is currently based in the U.S. that people should check out. There's Critical Resistance, who I already mentioned. There's a website called Everyday Abolition that people can check out that has a lot of strategies that people can think about. There's the group the Bay Area Transformative Justice Collective, who have popularized the idea of podding, which people could look into in terms of, you know, practices within friend groups for dealing with conflict and for dealing with harm. Yeah, those are some of the organizations that come to mind, some of the strategies that come to mind when thinking about how we get to a world without prisons and a world without police. One last thing I wanted to mention is that I feel like it's really important for people to do prisoner support, that a really important part of prison abolitionist politics is being in touch with people on the inside. It both shows people who don't have any experience with the prison system how necessary and urgent it is to abolish the prison system. It shows you the depth of what the system actually is. You know, it's not just the walls, it's the social workers on the outside and the halfway houses and the programs that people get forced into and all kinds of different things like that. I would say that the conversations I've had with people who have done lots of time have very seriously shaped my politics around abolition. And, you know, obviously not every single person you're going to be in touch with is going to be into abolition, but I certainly think that abolitionist politics necessitate being in touch with people on the inside.
I just wanted to mention that since the inception of prisons, as the way we know them, there has constantly been resistance to them, both from people who work very closely to prisons and prisoners, obviously. And that was, you know, inherited from the colonial state that came in from England. And since the inception of it, although it was brought about as an alternative and a more humane form of punishment, in their context, it was consistently opposed by many members of the community. But they were quashed. Their voices have been silenced, and it's a history that has been silenced as well, as if it's a natural, you know, a natural thing if we're going to be seeking justice in some way, as if it is. But even in our own minds, we don't have to go that far back or that far away to consider a world without prisons. It's close to what was around previous to its existence, actually. Not to say that we should go bring back torture, hold on a minute, or those means, but the fact that it has constantly, what the state has distributed as its form of justice has always been resisted against. It has never been part of a people's movement to build prisons. It has never been part of what people have wanted in their communities. It has been an imposed state of affairs. With very real goals. Call me by my number and you give me my bed.
So tell me, how do we get involved in abolitionist projects?
There are lots of different ways for people to get involved in abolitionist projects in Montreal. I'm sure you're going to talk to a lot of other people for this podcast, and so people will get a lot of different ideas. But just to name a few different options, there's the Prisoner Correspondence Project, which is a pen pal project and resource project for queer and trans prisoners, and puts them in touch with similar communities on the outside. There's the Anti-Carceral Group. There's the Certain Days Calendar Project, which, you know, if people are looking for educational materials and resources, Chris Blebedev Publishing is based in Montreal and has a ton of books both written by prisoners and written about the prison system that people could get to understand things better. There's a group called Open Door Books, which sends books to people in prison. And there's the Black Indigenous Harm Reduction Alliance, which last I checked was doing a fundraising drive to send care packages into women who are currently incarcerated in LeClaire Provincial Prison, which is one of a number of prisons that are all in the same block out in Laval, which is a suburb of Montreal. Those are projects I would mention that people could check out if they're looking to get involved in abolitionist politics in Montreal. Obviously, due to the pandemic, a lot of groups are on hold or might not get back to you as fast as they normally would, but hopefully things will be able to get going again at some point in the future.
The existence of police, of prisons, and the entire carceral system is doing more harm than good to our communities. Protecting the rich and the capitalist system while punishing poor and racialized people trying to survive within these confines. If we work together to create alternatives to prisons, we could build stronger communities that are more egalitarian and that focus on justice and equity rather than revenge and punishment. If you would like to know more about prison abolition and the negative effects of prisons on the people directly impacted and their communities, please check out our next episode, where we will be interviewing Helen Hudson, an abolitionist activist who's been in the game for more than 20 years.